History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are always stories there that are worth hearing, stories that should not go untold. So we ask a few questions, we listen, and it's amazing the perspective we gain. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only do we learn a lot, not only are we educated and entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. There's always a lot going on when November 11th rolls around on the calendar and hometowns all over America celebrate their veterans. It looked a little different this year because of COVID-19, call it the year of the virtual Veterans Day Parade, but so many things unfolded over the last week, and I'd like to draw your attention to at least a few of them today. For one, as of Veterans Day, the long-awaited National Museum of the U.S. Army is finally open at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, capturing nearly 250 years of Army history. Add that to your list the next time you visit the Washington, D.C. area. A day after that came news of the next group that's going to be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal, the nation's highest civilian honor, and it'll be the women who went to work to power the home front during World War II. Those Rosie the Riveters will be so honored. And you're going to hear from one of them in the coming weeks here on Hometown Heroes with enough energy and enthusiasm to run circles around most of us. I spent some time with many incredible people over the past week who have served our country, and I was reminded again of the power of our veterans and their palpable love for our country to bring the rest of us together. That was certainly the story in Visalia, California, where I got to watch five young ladies from Granite Hills High School in nearby Porterville present hand-sewn red, white, and blue patriotic blankets to veterans who will soon be experiencing an honor flight to Washington, D.C. By soon, I mean as soon as it's safe to do so, but these high school students gave up their lunch hours for a semester to make this moment possible. The looks on some of those veterans' faces told a more powerful story than I could possibly tell here, but I can share a few more layers to that story with you. One link I have up for you at hometownheroesradio.com is to a video piece by photojournalist Craig Colrus of the Fresno Bee, and in it you'll hear Chloe Ross, the founder of the Heartwarmers Club, explain the motivation behind that movement.
Heartwarmers is a community service club that I started at Granite Hills High School in Porterville. Our mission is to make blankets for those in need, and we've donated them to various community service organizations. This was a set that I started because of my great-grandfather, who was a Pearl Harbor survivor and a World War II veteran. When I saw that he was supposed to go on the flight in April, I really wanted to do something special to honor veterans. And so I rallied about 40 members who met every week in my high school classroom. And we made around 75 blankets for the veterans who were supposed to be on that flight. My great-grandfather was supposed to go on the flight in April, but he passed away in January. It's really sad for me. It's big in our family because of the service that my grandfather did. And so growing up with that kind of mindset and thankfulness for the freedoms that we have because of these veterans is very important to me. I'm really excited that we were able to do something like this. Unfortunately, we can't have our big parades. I'm involved in band, so Veterans Day Parade is always something super exciting for me. And so I was super sad that we weren't able to do that this year, but I'm glad that there was another way that we could honor these veterans.
The tears in their eyes and the emotion on their faces made it clear those veterans felt honored. Hats off to Chloe Ross and the Heartwarmers from Granite Hills High School in Porterville, California. And since she mentioned the inspiration behind that effort, her great-grandfather, who passed away before he could experience an honor flight to Washington, D.C., I want you to hear some of his story to round out your perspective. A native of Burley, Idaho, Chuck Keene joined the Navy in February 1941. We pick up his memories with the night of December 6, 1941, in Pearl Harbor, where the then 19-year-old was assigned to the cruiser USS Honolulu.
I was down and getting ready to do my first night of mess cooking aboard ship. At that time, everybody had to do 6 weeks of mess cooking, and that was the old chief cook was showing us all the things that we had to do, how to fix the trays. I was going to put the trays and wash, after the guys had eaten, I washed the trays and put them in a rack. That was going to be my job when I got up the next morning, and that's what I got up to. Is we no more started breakfast, and the general quarters alarm rang. I ran topside, and here was a Japanese Zero coming right down the dock, just strafing the hell out of things, you know. We didn't know, had never had any training on being under gunfire. I compare it to taking, pulling a little spool in the dirt, running along behind and seeing the dust come up behind a spool in the alleyway. Well, that's the way those bullets were coming down that thing. And we never had brain wanted to duck or anything like that. We just watched it go by. Everybody was just sort of in awe at because we'd never seen a plane like that. Every plane that they showed us had two wings and big propellers.
So, yeah, I mean, clearly this was shocking. This was unexpected. So what did you do when you came topside and you saw all that? What did you do with yourself?
Well, my buddy, Freeberg, from Seattle, we were topside searchlights, big searchlights. We had to man those searchlights. Well, it seemed sort of dumb to do anything with a searchlight in broad daylight. So we were down helping wherever we could, and I was helping try to get ammunition to these 3-inch guns because they had no provisions for that. They had a locker full of them, and so we'd throw the locker open and try to keep shells enough for the guns, and then the gun got hot and it jammed, and we just had all kinds of problems. Then you'd go to the next one. We just sort of all over the ship the first day until we were hit. They come by, they dropped a bomb, and it hit the dock and exploded underneath the ship and caved our whole front of the ship in, a 500-pound bomb, and so we couldn't go anywhere because our magazine had collapsed, and they were afraid it was going to blow up. And so the next 3 days, I spent myself down in my shorts and skivvies, you would say, and with stockings, and going down there sweeping up gunpowder with a foxtail and by the pail to get it out of there to where it's a miracle we didn't blow up right then, you know. But the only thing that they said that saved us was it collapsed the peak tanks where the water was. Forced the water right back into the magazine, and so it didn't explode. That's why I'm still here, because if that had gone off, we'd all been gone. But
well, and I know there are a couple other moments throughout the war where you might not have been here if it didn't go a certain way. But I'm wondering, while you're doing all this and this is happening, while you realize your ship is under attack, did you ever have a chance to look out and see what else was happening throughout Pearl Harbor?
They flew right by our fantailed, the torpedo bombers that were torpedoing the battleships come right by. They swoop down into the water just in back of our ship and launch their torpedoes for the battleships. We had what they call a blister. Those torpedoes didn't do much damage to the ship because they put right in 39 or somewhere along there. They put what they call 6-inch blisters on the battleship, so they decided to make him so the torpedoes wouldn't hit them. They pretty well sheltered it off, but the ones that got all of it was the armor pierced, and they flew and they dropped the bombs down, and they come down through the deck that way and exploded. But the big explosion we heard was the Shaw and two ships in dry dock. They exploded. And that just, like, crushed me. It killed one guy on the dock because, you see, the docks have a revetment alongside there that you can put stuff back in, that's cinder block or whatever it is like that, and all of your weapons and everything were stored back in that area. Well, this guy was standing in there, so when the blast that hit me went on through, it hit him, but it come off the back of that thing, and he just crushed him. And that's the first time that I saw a guy just dead by explosion. I mean, it just killed him.
Well, and you said something about yourself feeling that too. So what did you feel? What did you experience?
My experience was just like somebody grabbed me and just crushed my lungs. And I couldn't, for a minute, I didn't think I was ever going to really breathe again. It marked me so that even after the war, sudden sounds for a long time. They never had any therapy or any way to treat us for it, but if sudden sound would shake, and I'd be shaking inside. You know, I could hold my hands here, but it seemed like everything inside was jerking. It takes several hours for that to go away. I had that for years, you know, every sudden noises or something shake. But that big damage that I had was that explosion aboard that dry dock.
Well, that's one of the most captivating photos from Pearl Harbor, is the Shaw. Yeah, the concussion of that explosion smacked you in the chest.
Smashed me, yeah. It knocked me down. I couldn't stand. I mean, I went down. I didn't know what had happened to me. And then I got up. You can't imagine getting hit. Well, if you played football or something, you might, but it's not really as hard because it crushes you from both sides. You just feel like everything's coming out your mouth.
So, again, this is a 19-year-old kid from Idaho who's been living in paradise, and now his world is turned upside down. And I was struck by something you wrote down for your family, a few memories, when you said, "We were attacked on December 7th, 1941 by the Japanese." You wrote, "Our fleet was destroyed, and so was my innocence." What did you mean by that?
Well, I'd never seen death before. I'd never seen that my kind of suffering. I never did, and never have since. The worst day of the war was the worst day of my life. It was awful. It all seemed like it all run together to the 11th, to December 11th. It seemed like there was no night or day. We were just trying to clean up, you know. We still had guys trapped underwater. We had guys trying to get out. We had a lot of 2,000 guys burned laying on the dock trying to take care of them. It was just a big mess for till the 11th. Then we finally, they said, well, on the 11th, they came out and said, well, we're going to go back to San Francisco, because we didn't know how much damage it had on the ship, but it was extensive, and we had to go get it fixed. So that put us back in perspective, and it calmed down a little bit. We had some of our ships, planes trying to fly in from one of the other airports to fly in there, and our guys were so gun-shy, they were shooting at our own planes.
And you mentioned sweeping up the gunpowder to try to avoid a secondary explosion.
Yeah.
What else were you doing for those next few days after the attack?
Mostly repairing the bulkhead so the ship could get out. And believe it or not, we had to use timber. We had timber on there. I never dreamed that they'd have it on there, but we had 4x4s, 4x6, and so we could block that side of the ship if we got underway, that it wouldn't cave in any more than where it was. So I was being carpenter for part of the time, and tying things up. We tied everything up that we could, and just got rid of all the junk on there. Anything that we didn't need to go to war, you got rid of. You'd be surprised how much crap you'd get aboard a ship, you know, that you don't need.
And, you know, we know with the lens of history, we know that the Japanese came in two waves that day to Oahu, and they were also hitting other places like the Philippines and Clark Field. But you guys didn't know if they were coming back to Oahu again after December 7th. Was there a concern that more was coming in the days that followed?
Yes. They were sure that there's going to be carriers in there, and they never realized that he'd turned these carriers around and gone back to Japan. But according to the amount of fuel and weaponry and everything that we had on ours, we could figure they could have come right on in. So we were under alert entirely. For the next, I guess they stayed on alert even after we got out of there, and they wanted everything that could move and get out, because they figured another more attack. One of the most vivid things is cutting the guy's mouth open to find how many teeth they had so they could identify them, but they didn't have an ID card or tag. The only way you could check them would be with their dental records. You just had to pry open the guy's mouth to count the teeth. That was horrible to me. I mean, to this day, I've never got over that, but we had to do it. You had to find out who they were, and most of them, they successfully located a lot of them, but some they didn't, which, you know, there's 408, I think, of the ones that first day that they couldn't identify.
You got put on a detail to go bury some of them?
Yes, I was on a detail to bury them. I was also on the detail when we were identifying the ones that were seriously hurt. Some of the hangars on the island were, we collected them, but they buried up above Honolulu, up there on the thing. I really have trouble with that because I was up there, but I couldn't tell anybody how you get up there to it, you know, but it was a hill.
It's the Punch Bowl crater, which is now an American cemetery. A lot of people go to the Arizona Memorial and everything that's around Pearl Harbor, but the Punch Bowl is one of the most moving places I've ever been.
That's where we put them in, and we never had identification for all of them, and on the ones that we didn't, they put their dental records, or and keep in mind that it's 72 degrees, it's hot, and you know what happens to bodies when it gets warm, they go to swelling, and we had to get them buried. And so that shocked me that we couldn't do any more than what we did. We just took a string and tied it around their neck and put their ID up on the post. So, and that's the way but they were the lucky ones. They were the ones that could be identified, and some of them didn't, you know, we didn't know it. And then they would put their dental record up there.
And the ones that weren't identified in recent years, there's been an exhumation, and they have gone back, and they've been able to identify quite a few of those sailors.
I sort of blocked that out of my mind. I knew they were doing it. They were covering guys up. That's what the way that it was told to me. A chief told me, he says, they're covering them up. And I knew that he meant they were just burying them.
Well, and you underscore the urgency of doing that for just physical reasons. But did it weigh on you at the time that those people, those victims of this attack, were not identified, and that their families would not have that final answer?
That didn't bother me. The thing that bothered me more than anything else is they gave me morphine. And for all of them that were crying or hollering, you know, for something, he just said, just give them a shot of morphine. Well, we were going along there, we were shoving morphine into those guys, and I thought I'd killed about 400, and I never knew until the nurse come here that I couldn't. You know, I had that on my mind for 60 years that I helped kill them, but they say I didn't, so I got some relief from that. But she said that if you put morphine into a muscle, it's not going to kill anybody, you know, with the dose that we give. But if it went into a vein or an artery, it could, but where you just put it in the arm, it didn't. They said you give them relief. And I know from being an explosion myself that morphine will certainly do away with pain right away. I myself screamed for it in an explosion aboard John C. Butler. I mean, one of the main connections exploded while I was trying to show the yard superintendent what was happening, and it just boom, it arced, and no fuse, no nothing. It's tied into the main energy on the dock. We just melted a hole, and we had a half-inch steel. Just melted down, and it knocked me out. I don't know what happened that I got out, but when I came to, I was in a van, and they had a pull motor on me. I think that's probably as close to dead as I've ever been, because I can always remember just like circles of gray just going back and forth, and all of a sudden I realized I'm moving, and they had me in an ambulance taking me to the Naval Hospital in Long Beach.
Chuck Keen was a witness to incredible death and destruction at Pearl Harbor. That last story illustrates how close he came to death himself. And this isn't melodrama, this is reality. If he had not survived that and more during World War II, 70 California veterans would not be enjoying those comfy red, white, and blue blankets this holiday season, because his great-granddaughter, Chloe Ross, would have never been here to launch that Heartwarmers Club inspired by Chuck's service in World War II. You can link to Mr. Keene's complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a new way of telling World War II stories that's appealing to a whole new generation. I don't think I've ever directed you to Netflix before, but wait till you hear about The Liberator. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.